Standing in the Alpha Beta parking lot, watching the sunset. I'll never forget watching all the reds and oranges slip away, letting go of yet another dirty day. So many idling cars right beneath the sign with the dusty yellow stars, watching the sun go down, watching the sun go down, watching. Lot, watching you leave me, not quite believing.
We're thinking about just calling this show Technical Difficulties. So
there's always something.
I have a question for you, sir.
All right, fire away.
When you left Always Record, did synchronicity just disappear from your life completely?
It just stopped. It went away. There's nothing syncs. It's just this, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's been going. It's just a nonstop count. It's very odd. I'm looking for some more sync in my life.
For real?
No.
Okay.
No.
There's no escaping.
Well, I mean,
it's Titanic, you know.
It's like riding a bike, right? You know, you walk out your door, and there it is. I think I had mentioned to you that, which is funny because I'll explain. I had finally committed to memory the Hebrew alphabet, the tarot, and the Tree of Life, just where everything is situated. And the Zodiac,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I finally just went through like the week-long process of just committing it to memory.
In a week?
Well, let's put it this way, David. I mean, I have been studying the systems separately together probably the last...
I gotcha.
15 years.
Of just taking it and being like, impressing it. Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just sort of like, it's like a jigsaw puzzle where you didn't connect the pieces, you just put them right next to the piece that they would connect to.
Sure.
And then you spend a week just, all right, let's just put the puzzle together. And that is some powerful juju, man. That's crazy talk.
Totally. You know, what's really interesting about when you do that, when you set it into your memory, that's when, because everything's correspondence, synchronicity is correspondence, and so if you know this corresponds to this, and then it comes up, and you see multiple things come up simultaneously, and then they all respond to each other, or in interesting ways, like, that's pretty key. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, the way that you languaged what correspondences were, I think I even dictated down what you had said on a particular episode of Always Record and put it out in a blog's post, because you just completely clarified it for me, you know. But the system of correspondences, and I think that's it really, obviously I'm a big Marshall McLuhan guy, so flipping things instead of just going with the message, trying to find out what is the medium of this whole thing, what is the mechanical or the engineering behind why this system is important. And that's what I've really been focusing on. And it's really kind of helped me to get to some much needed clarity in some of this confusion.
Cool.
Because for me right now, a quick illustration. My favorite thing to do that for me wraps up the whole synchrosphere I guess, is to basically eat edible marijuana and go out on long walks. So, for me, it encapsulates every most of the aspects of what I've read and learned about over the last 15 years. There's a little bit of alchemy of taking the plant and cooking it and transforming it, and then the consuming it is sort of like a sacrament. And then you go out in the path. You're always just one foot in front of the other. There's nothing else. You're just putting one foot in front of the other and letting the whole world around you tell a story.
Man, I rarely
And
do that anymore. I mean, I'll go for walks, but I don't. Well, edible marijuana. I don't know. It's been like fucking 2 years or 3 years or something, but maybe longer. But I hear what you're saying. I used to do that all the time, man. And things will sink on the road. It's crazy.
yeah, it's the whole Crowley illustrates it really beautiful. I think it's in book four about walking out his door, and then he connects, a number on a house to the color of a rose to a bird flying in the air, and he starts to illustrate how this engine that you have in your mind that is usually unconscious. Because of these correspondences, you start to kind of coax the unconscious into the light, and then you start to realize that whether you know it or not, there's this story that's continually being told in your head. And there's what I think that Crowley is very wise in how he doesn't put constraints on exactly what the story is. He just sort of says, it's sort of like free radio in your head, and you can tune into it and get rid of a lot of the static, and there's value into that transmission, into that signal.
Yeah.
Right? And but in order to do that, there are certain exercises that you need to do because we are creatures out of our natural habitat, we're city folk, and we live in this it's a simulacrum. I mean, it's an idealized version of something that was in our head, or something that we were chasing. But when you're out in like the jungles or out in the wilderness, or your brain works the way it's supposed to. But when you're in a city, your brain works according to how the city wants you to. And there's a very big distinction there, I think.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's really funny. I had a vision that was about an hour ago of you and Kevin Halcott and John. And it's funny that you'd immediately bring up Mr. Crowley, 'cause that was the idea. I was like, get Kevin Halcott and Bill to talk about fucking Crowley, but whatever.
Can you hear me okay? Do I sound less weird?
You sound perfect.
Okay.
Okay, we're great. We're on. We have a show. You're gonna
All
be with
right.
us for like another hour or something, or another hour and a half. Is that the deal?
Yeah, like hour and a half.
Okay, cool. All right. Hey, so have you two ever met on this on in the
I
Skype
don't think
world?
so.
Oh,
I've
okay.
listened to Bill quite a bit, but I've never met him. So, yes, nice to meet you.
It's so weird because I was convinced that we had talked before.
No, I don't think so.
Well, you
Maybe in
well,
another life.
maybe I've talked to
okay, well, you two sync, because we got John Maguire and William John. So we got William John Maguire on
There
the
you
call.
go.
That works for me. But yeah,
Hey,
so this is the first time, I think.
has anyone ever told you, John, that your voice sounds like honey?
Only once before, and I was extremely flattered,
You
but
got
also
sweet
weirded
pipes,
out.
bro. You've got sweet pipes.
Yeah. So I appreciate that.
Absolutely. My voice sounds like bacon.
But not like fried, but like cured, what's that, Italian bacon?
Oh boy.
Yeah, I don't know.
I like Jewish bacon. Wait a minute.
There you go.
No. All right, you guys. Let's see here. I don't know. I guess technically, like when Alan's not here, I'm supposed to like step up to be ha Happy Harry Hard On. I'm supposed to be that radio personality, and I'm not very good at that, like, you know, the man. So we're all on equal sides of the round table right now.
Well,
I can't
take
the
reins.
I'm not.
Bill's here, so why don't we catch up with Bill? Bill, have you been doing anything sync related, or have you just been totally taking time away from all of it?
Well, like as David was asking me, is that, you know, it's impossible to necessarily take time away from it, because really, once you're in, you're in. It's just a matter of how much pressure you put on the thing itself. Like, I guess it's sort of like if you have a craft. And then I'm not saying there's anything ridiculously professional about blogging or doing podcasting or whatever, but there is an element that where, you know, you're on, and there's another dimension to it. So I'm always working on the craft, but I just wasn't on for a while. Wasn't on the air. Wasn't writing. And that just sort of it. It's a more casual approach to it, even though I probably have made more progress in this dimension than I had the last year I was doing Always Record and writing. And I think that's the key to a lot of this work, is that it should always evolve. It should always change. And I think you'll see that with a lot of the, especially with the bloggers out there. It's very rare for a sync blogger to be writing consistently month in, month out, month in, month out. You'll see times when their production is up and then times when the production is down. And I just think that's the most kind of organic way to approach it. It's the only way to maintain your sanity, I think, with this stuff. So
you have to defocalize, I think. You can.
Yeah.
That applies to a lot of areas, too. Oftentimes, like scientists that had their eureka moments, they're defocalizing and it comes to mind or something. So your best ideas almost come when you're not focusing on them or fixating on them with the same kind of consciousness. So your subconscious is working on ideas. But you can only do that by pulling back. Like,
right.
It's the same thing in if you play cards or any kind of game of chance or something. If you know how to play the game, it's like, you know, there's like ups and downs associated with it. But you have to take like time away from it now and then. And then when you come back, usually it's like even easier, or it feels like you have kind of a zen about it, a different type of headspace.
Yeah.
But that's just my experience.
The sabbatical, I'm assuming it comes from the word Sabbath then.
I would imagine so. Yeah. Shabbat. Shabbatical.
So, yeah, man. I mean, there's some value in keeping that day of rest as sort of a disciplined component of the whole thing. There's some wisdom in there, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for, you know, I always felt like it was kind of misleading. Like when Einstein would talk about how, like, his best realizations came from, you know, when he was taking a break. But the thing is that it's the culmination of all the time that he spent immersed in the thing, and then it's when he backs up that he has the aha moment. But, like, if he didn't spend all the fucking time immersed in it, it wouldn't work that way. You can't just, you know, just expect these things to happen on their own without that other side to it. So you spent time spinning around with something, but it's not until you step back that you're like, oh, shit, I get it. And so, you know, like, just recently I've had, like, three, you know, sync breakthroughs where I've made videos. But all of that stuff came from Always Record. All of those videos came from basically communicating, and then all these pieces come together, and then it's not until I, like, just allow them to do their thing that they actually start to take shape and I see something actually, like, come of it. It's kind of weird the way that that happens, but, like...
Well, there's, like, a feedback cycle between... two reservoirs of thought, almost. It's like if we're in an information field, right? It's like an information gradient. So stuff is sloshing back and forth within the two different sides, and that creates, that's like the creative impulse, that like primordial movement of thought. So it has to move in different ways to evolve.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of. Totally. Yeah.
It's a Bohmian thing. I often go back to him. It's like I finally got my hands on some of his older books, and they're so good. The ones he wrote with David Peet, who I can't wait to have on like in a few months when his book comes back out again.
Oh, what books are those?
Like Science, Creativity,
on Creativity?
No, that's just pure Bohm. He wrote another one with Peet that's called Science, Creativity, and something else.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I know.
And that was written in like 85, 86.
Nice.
There's another one by Peet called Looking Glass Universe that I just finished, and that was a really good one. And that synthesizes Bohm. Prigogine, who does Open System, Order from Chaos stuff, the Holographic Brain, and then Morphic Resonance.
Nice.
So they try to synthesize all those ideas. And that was like the fucking 30 years ago. You know, I thought when I was like happening upon those ideas and starting to like blend them together, I'm like, oh man, I'm on to something. But someone's always done something before you. And when you really look at it, that's what I've come to read. Like, no one has any original thoughts. Somewhere, some place, someone has like probably done a mirror image of what you've done in some way.
Right.
But that's the human thing. I mean, I don't know. That's how art's supposed to work. So,
yeah.
Going back to our old conversation about copyright and stuff, it's a little ridiculous to try to keep that information pool segregated from like the human.
Yeah, well, Bohm is next level
experience.
Because I mean, he'll be taking these things that you're like, you could equate them with like ancient systems for sure. Like they're nothing new, but those ancient systems were not peer reviewed in today's standard. You know, like it's extremely empirical, and everything is like cross checked to like a very high degree, and so it's another level to it. It's not like he just took some old idea, put a new package on it. No, he took an old idea and then put it to the test, and then came out with it. But yeah, the only things I've read by Bohm are Dialogue on Dialogue.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And Thought as a System, and what he did with Krishnamurti, The Ending of Time, which is my favorite, and obviously the Holographic Universe.
Yes.
His contribution to the Holographic Universe.
I still haven't read the one with Krishnamurti. I've just seen some of their talks. And I like how Bohm holds back a lot. He let the other person talk quite a bit, which I appreciate that. And then like if like someone comes to him, then he has a lot to say. But he has I'm forgetting what the word is, reticent.
I yeah, think. He's
so he has all these
reserved.
Ideas, super reserved, and like one of the wisest people like you'll ever hear, and not a hint of ego in like anything he says or suggests, which leads me to take his ideas more credibly because like when ego's involved, then I can't take it as seriously sometimes. Even if it's a good idea.
Yeah.
I guess I'm resistant to that. But his idea of orders, you know, orders upon orders, the universe, right? We're looking for like the primordial thing, but we're never going to find it. We're just going to find more orders. So below classical physics, you have quantum physics. And then below quantum physics, there's something else. And it's an unending game. And he's just like, you know what? There's just infinite orders, and we should be willing to change the paradigm from time to time to reconcile with that truth, because it's like everything's a regress. So we discover rocks, and we dig down to atoms, and we dig down to nucleons, and then quarks, and then there's something else, but we just can't get there yet. But it's inevitable, I think. So I mean, his idea of orders interacting on top of orders, it's very systemic view of things.
Yeah, the Rhea mode really got me. So basically, looking at language and the way that our subject-object relationship is totally skewed from if you're looking at his, you know, implicit order, and you're talking about the enfoldment of things and the implications of that, our language system, it doesn't mirror or reflect what we should know to be true. And so something has to change there. And so he was looking at some of the specifics around what could change to be more in line with what our understanding of the universe actually is. And so like when I was silent for 5 months, I didn't even want to write I on my chalkboard. Like it stopped making sense. Like a lot of things stop making sense. And if you don't, if your voice in your head goes away that you always hear, generally, you know, when that's no longer there and you're just trying to communicate without that, a lot of the things, the way that we phrase things just makes less and less sense. And I actually came across the RIA mode when I was in the middle of that. And then I actually came across a really weird self-published book about Sri Ramana Maharshi, where they were looking at his language, because the bits that are left of like his talks, like he talks in a completely different way sometimes, and they were just analyzing that and like basically being like, well, how would you say it if you wanted to reflect what his Vedantic understanding is? And it was like, all the rules changed, you know. It was really cool. I checked it out from a library at a community I was working at, and then there is no other copy in existence, probably. That was the only copy. And then I went back to look for it again, and it was gone. I was like, somebody probably just took that, you know.
Yeah, sometimes you find like a really cool book, and you just have to have it.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of the number 23 when they, you know, it's like this like super weird obscure book, although he wrote that. I don't know if I wrote this book and just blocked it, but
Robert Anton Wilson played a similar game with language, and he was doing what you can't say is or something like that with the quantum logic. I think that was his approach to language for a while, and he tried to do that without saying is, but instead you say it appears to me as. So there's no definite stamp of dogma attached to anything. It's just like it could be, or if I'm gambling, I'd say it's likely. But there's never anything that you could like rule out as a matter of fact, if like it, not every anomaly has been addressed or something like that. So it's about like keeping ideas on the table and not like labeling anything or dismissing anything.
It's kind of like talking to young children. I once heard that if you're talking to a young kid and you want them to do something other than what they're doing, you just always give them two choices. You never say, stop what you're doing and go do this, because it's just not going to happen. But if you say, hey, do you want to do this or do you do that? They'll just naturally gravitate towards one of the choices that they like. And it usually works 9 times out of 10.
Totally.
And it's just a subtle twist in your language. And it makes you even more of a creative person, because you have to think of two alternatives to the situation, and it just sort of opens your mind up to the dualistic minimum of really what reality seems to be, I think. So
yeah, I had mixed feelings on it's one of Crowley's books about the magical diary, and
oh yeah,
he has a thing about basically thinking certain things that if you think them, you literally cut yourself, which is not the healthiest activity probably, but it was like, if you think I, you cut yourself, and then you get to the small cut, but you get to the point where you stop thinking I. You know, I don't know if that's the best way to go about it, because I mean, it should just come out from, you know, I mean, but it's definitely, that's a way to remind yourself.
He invented the swear jar. You know, the jar for swearing, where if you say, you know, for parents when they have kids and they stop using the F word or bad words around their kids, and they have a jar, and anytime you say a profanity, you throw a dime in there. I think that's in book 4.
Yeah, but he had a requirement that everyone give him the jars after they were done.
Yeah, he's a genius, man.
And then he used it to buy cigars and cognac.
And yeah, and prostitutes. Brilliant.
How much of his life would you guys say is made up and or overinflated or fictionalized?
So here's the thing, man. I did a thing where I read Confessions. And then a couple years later, I read a book called, I forget who wrote it. I actually loaned it to a friend of mine just recently. If you're gonna buy the rights to a movie to make a movie, buy the rights to Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley and British Intelligence and the Occult, or it's called something like that. And basically, where it talks about the Lusitania and his part in the sinking of the Lusitania. What's really fascinating is that if you take that book, and this is that book is extremely empirical. Everything is backed up with it's disclosed stuff from British intelligence, and they're like looking at this material, and this guy wasn't oriented in the occult, and he's like, "Who's this Crowley guy that keeps coming up? What the fuck is this guy doing?" And I mean, he helped spin basically, essentially, it's the propaganda of the false flag event that was the sinking of the Lusitania, where we put a ship into German waters knowing it would be sunk. That was a cargo ship filled with supplies for war, but also a passenger ship, and so all these innocent people died. And that was what was used. One of the things that was used to get Britain and the U.S. involved in World War One. But what's really crazy is that if you take that book and you put it side by side with Confessions, everywhere they go in Secret Agent 666, everywhere he goes, you can see he's going there in Confessions for entirely different reasons. And so you walk away from it being like, okay, wait a minute. It could go either way. It could go that he was actually doing both, which I don't rule out, or it was just a cover. Or if that's the joke on that, it's Confessions, is that he's actually confessing something else other than what he's confessing by doing that, because he's giving you an outline of where he went, but not giving you what he did, but rather giving you like a metaphor for what he did. You can take it that way. It's just a really weird thing. And so you're like, well, which part is true and which part isn't? I don't really know. My favorite story from Crowley's childhood is the maid, when he got it on with the maid. And before he did it, he was really young. He was like a kid, right? And he goes to the local tobacco shop beforehand, and he tells the tobaccoist, look, If my parents or if anybody comes in here and asks if I was in here on this day at this time to buy tobacco, you tell them yes. And so he gets it on with the maid, and then his parents ask him if it's true, because the maid basically tells on him, and he says, "I'll tell you, I got to confess, I was smoking tobacco during the time I went out and I bought tobacco." And so what do you know? His parents go and they ask the local tobacco guy, and he's like, yeah, he was here. And then the maid gets fired. You know, it's just like, that's like pretty conniving, you know. That's a
sign. Or just really good fiction, right? I mean, it's a small microcosm of that entire book.
You know? Right. It could go either way, totally.
So I don't know how to always designate fact versus fiction with him, but I think it's all interesting nonetheless, and there's no historical figure that's not unmythologized, so it's almost a rite of passage to have stuff made up about you if you're going to be truly famous.
I think with Crowley, it's probably 93% true.
93.
Oh, you go that high?
No,
I don't know if I go that high.
He's saying 93 because 93 is the lemma. So.
Oh, okay.
He's being clever.
With guys like that, I've met people like that. At first, they come off as bombastic and obnoxious, which is exactly how Crowley would enter a room. He's not going to enter unnoticed. And, I've just met people where you go, this guy's full of it. This is not true. And the more you spend time with them, most of it's true. There's a thin layer of embellishment and exaggeration. And then every now and then, something isn't true. But for the most part, where they get their bravado and where they get their sense of identity is through having the audacity to do this shit. Because most the whole society, the way human beings are over the last 100 years, is that there's room to do this shit. It's exploiting the masses. You know? I tend to believe most of what is out there. I don't know.
I just read okay.
I'm sorry, David. Is Bill cutting out for you?
Yeah, a little bit. You're cutting out a little bit, Bill.
All right. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I think it'll probably be
okay. It's not horrible or anything. I'm just double checking. It's not me.
Yeah. So I just read a quote the other day. I got a tattoo on my arm that says Gonzo. you know, and somebody sent me a, or posted in relationship to that, a statement from Hunter S. Thompson talking about what Gonzo is, the nature of Gonzo, and basically saying that there's this idea that the best fiction is oftentimes truer than what we call journalism. And, you know, that, and the best journalists have always been aware of this. And so, like, he'd have examples, though, where, like, where he would be accusing somebody of politician of taking ibogaine, and then you know, they'd be like, "Is that true?" And he would be like, "Well, you know, there was a rumor going around that that was true." And he's like, "Well, I started that rumor." You know, it's like it's like, but the thing is that look at the guy; it might as well be true. You know, I mean, I'm really into. Like, I use the word empirical a lot because I appreciate people that bother to be empirical. And at the same token, sometimes, you know, the way media operates is, like, most of the time it's sensationalism. It's not, I mean, what better way to attack that than to reflect that same principle in a more obvious way? I think that that's actually a good thing to a degree. And so I obviously resonate with it, otherwise I wouldn't have got it tattooed, but it's also the Gonzo being the weird factor, the thing that's not quite, reconcilable, or able to integrate into the thing ends up changing it. It's like the idea of inertia, that it's something moving in a straight line and nothing will deviate its course unless it's something outside of it. Gonzo is the thing outside of it. So yeah, but Crowley was definitely all about Gonzo. He was an originator of Gonzo in contemporary times. You know,
my favorite framing of Gonzo is seemingly rather mundane, but I think it captures it, or at least it captures it enough for me. Is kind of like a 1950s baseball on the radio. You'd have two people, or maybe one person, watching something actually happening on the field, but filling in all the gaps with a heightened sense of urgency or with flourishes that make it more exciting. Now, the batter comes up and hits a routine ground ball to the second baseman, and the runner's out. That's what happened. But the announcer puts a little bit more excitement into it, making the actual play seem a little bit more exciting, and the listener gets the truth, but they get a heightened sense of truth. It didn't really happen the way the announcer says it did, but you know what? You're listening to the radio, you're listening to baseball. It should be the most boring thing in the world. You're on the edge of your seat. And someone who's good at Gonzo can almost construct an entire game based around these flourishes and using all literary techniques to almost make it a theater. So you hear the game through the announcer. The truth is happening, but you're hearing it through a very skilled, you know, person.
Totally, and that's
something that was completely lost with television. And you see television try to recapture the magic of radio by adding all the special effects, by adding the replays and other shit, and it's never going to be as exciting as a really important baseball game that occurred on the radio. Have probably more profound memories from that school of journalism than you have from baseball and HDTV. So that's kind of that for me is like the ideal. Like, so if you hear what happened in the 70s through Hunter S. Thompson, you're going to get the exact same story, but you're going to have a better, your intuitive faculties will be played into understanding just exactly what happened, how did it reflect what's happening now. I think it's, I think there's more truthiness to it.
Yeah, you're not going to get the Greek tragedy. You're going to get the Seder chorus.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's it. So, but you, I mean, in today's world, that's, everything is, our explicitness has gone beyond into something that is not explicit. It's a conundrum. It's, I think people recognize it in their heads, but they don't know exactly why it's happening. It's definitely confusing.
Yeah. Interesting.
I think that's you can find that in theater versus versus film. You can have a more profound emotional guttural experience watching four people on stage without any props where a murder takes place than if you go to see some movie where the murder is actually shown.
Oh, go ahead and you can finish.
No, you're going to carry the impact of the violence so much more than this thin layer of explicit blood and guts. Because you're actually in the presence of emotion.
Well, television itself, you know, it's not a book I've read, but it's a book that's always been on my list, and I've listened to him speak. His name is Jerry Mander, and he wrote Four Arguments Against Television, basically. And he was like an ad executive, and he just grew to hate television. So he wrote this book, and this is back, I don't know, early 80s, maybe even late 70s. It was a while ago, and well before like too many people started philosophizing on the impact of TV. And he wrote that book. And anyway, it's just interesting that you kind of sync up TV and creativity almost, because he says that, well, you know, boredom is almost the root of creativity. So you have to almost give room to feel the boredom, or to like let it embrace you and take you down into the abyss of the boredomness.
Oh, absolutely. And then,
like something comes out of that, right? But if you don't let yourself get to that place, if you have fucking TV or you have whatever is your drug of choice, because television is a drug. I mean, every culture has its drugs. What is a foundation upon? Ours is just alcohol and TV. But it definitely fucks that side of your head, or part of yourself. So it's going to have that impact for sure. And it does all kinds of other weird stuff to you. When you really think about what TV is, it's strange, very strange. Our culture is strange. I often think about like how we're going to be seen in like 1,000 years, like how historians are going to chronicle our society and like what we fetishized and stuff. I was just talking with my girlfriend about this the other day, like what our culture fetishizes. Like we look back on like China in the late 19th century or something, and they like bound women's feet. But at the same time, you look at our culture, right? And it's like, what kind of strange shit is gonna pop out at people in 1,000 years? And I think coming to terms with that weirdness, and then like understanding that, I don't know, for getting into sync and being a creative person is kind of what it's all about when you realize everything else is kind of bullshit, I guess.
I'm gonna read to you from Krishnamurti's The First and Last Freedom. Because it popped in my mind, and the book is right in front of me, and so I grabbed it, and it's only 2 pages long, and so I'm just going to go for it, if you guys don't mind.
All right,
go for it.
Okay. This is a question. I'm not interested in anything, but most people are busy with many interests. I don't have to work, so I don't. Should I undertake some useful work? Krishnamurti. Become a social worker or a political worker or a religious worker. Is that it? Because you have nothing else to do, therefore you become a reformer! Exclamation point. If you have nothing to do, if you are bored, why not be bored? Why not be that? If you are in sorrow, be sorrowful. Don't try and find a way out of it, because your being bored has an immense significance. If you can understand it, live with it. If you say, I am bored, therefore I will do something else, you are merely trying to escape from boredom. And as most of us, as most of our activities are escapes, you do much more harm socially in every other way. The mischief is much greater when you escape than when you are what you are and remain with it. The difficulty is how to remain with it and not run away. As most of our activities are a process of escape, it is immensely difficult for you to stop escaping and face it. Therefore, I am glad if you are really bored and I say, full stop, let's stay there, let's look at it. Why should you do anything? If you're bored, why are you bored? What is the thing called boredom? Why is it that you are not interested in anything? There must be reasons and causes which have made you dull. Suffering, escapes, beliefs, incessant activities have made your mind dull, the heart unpliable. If you could find out why you are bored, why there is no interest, then surely you would solve the problem, wouldn't you? Then the awakened interest will function. If you are not interested in why you are bored, you cannot force yourself to be interested in an activity, merely to be doing something, like a squirrel going around in a cage. I know that this is the kind of activity most of us indulge in, but we can find out inwardly, psychologically, why we are in this state of utter boredom. We can see most of us are in this state. We have exhausted ourselves emotionally and mentally. We have tried so many things, so many sensations, so many amusements, so many experiments, that we have become dull, weary. We join one group, do everything wanted of us, and then leave it. And then we go to something else and try that. If we fail with one psychologist, we go to somebody else or to the priest. If we fail there, we go to another teacher, and so on. We always keep going. This process of constantly stretching and letting go is exhausting, isn't it? Like all sensations, it soon dulls the mind. We have done that. We have gone from sensation to sensation, from excitement to excitement, till we come to a point when we are really exhausted. Now, realizing that, don't proceed any further. Take a rest. Be quiet. Let the mind gather strength by itself. Don't force it. As the soil renews itself during the winter time, so when the mind is allowed to be quiet, it renews itself. But it is very difficult to allow the mind to be quiet, to let it lie fallow after all this. For the mind wants to be doing something all the time. When you come to that point where you are really allowing yourself to be as you are, bored, ugly, hideous, or whatever it is, then there is a possibility of dealing with it. What happens when you accept something, when you accept what you are, when you accept that you are what you are? Where is the problem? There is a problem only when you do not accept the thing as it is and wish to transform it, which does not mean that I am advocating contentment. On the contrary, if we accept what we are, then we see that the thing which we dreaded, the thing which we called boredom, the thing which we called despair, the thing which we called fear, has undergone a complete change. There is a complete transformation of the thing of which we were afraid. That is why it is important, as I said, to understand the process, the ways of our own thinking. Self-knowledge cannot be gathered through anybody, through any book, through any confession, psychology, or psychoanalyst. It has to be found by yourself because it is your life. Without the widening and deepening of that knowledge of the self, do what you will, alter any outward or inward circumstances, influences, it will ever be a breeding ground of despair, pain, sorrow. To go beyond the self-enclosing activities of the mind, you must understand them. And to understand them is to be aware of action in relationship. Relationship to things, to people, and to ideas. In that relationship, which is the mirror, we begin to see ourselves without any justification or condemnation. And from that wider and deeper knowledge of the ways of our own mind, it is possible to proceed further. It is possible for the mind to be quiet, to receive that which is real. Pretty cool, huh?
Spot on, basically. I mean, what book was that again?
That was The First and Last Freedom by Jay Krishnamurti, which is actually one of my favorite Krishnamurti books, just because it's just got these different sections on different issues, and then it's like question, response, and then they're all very short.
So. Now, let me ask you, how did Krishnamurti come to realization of what he just said?
He was put into a position where basically an unbelievable amount of people put stock in him as being their savior. And if
he, as a child, they plucked him, right, as a child.
Right. So he was literally adopted by the Theosophical Society. And so he just reached a breaking point where he was like, you're all fucking insane. And so it spawned a reaction in him that extended for the rest of his life, basically. Which is, now, the irony is so intense when you look at Krishnamurti and then you look at Crowley, because Crowley's doing everything in his power to become the thing that they're trying to force Krishnamurti to be, and Krishnamurti's doing everything he can to basically transcend that.
See, I think that I don't necessarily believe that about Crowley. I think he projects that, but that's part of his, you know what I mean? That's part of how he penetrates through that initial veil of getting people to actually do the work.
Well, Crowley certainly, that's why he went over the heads of the, you know, they had, so you, if you get a 32nd degree in Freemasonry, you don't have to be approved by any council. You know, you have to be approved to get to 33rd degree, and he was rejected, and he went over their heads. So he went to the guy above them. He's very ambitious when it came to positions of power. And there's no secret there, you know. I mean, he's very upfront about that, you know. He would like to be the Megatherian, the world teacher. Like, if you read the way that he phrases his relationship to that, it's very, like, matter of fact. Like, he definitely has a real desire for that.
And I think ego is an inseparable part of that, Bill. I mean, that's what I would argue. It's like, maybe, but I don't think maybe he has stuff to teach and whatnot, but even like a great teacher can be kind of egomaniacal. But well, it's all about separating the message from the messenger a little bit.
True, but I think Carroll taught from his non-ego and he taught from his ego. And he did realize that in the social climate that he was trying to do his great work, that the voice that was emanating from his ego was just as important as the voice that was from his non-ego. I mean, it's a huge foundation of everything that is Crowley, and no one ever really goes into that, you know.
Right.
No one really ever spends, like, puts the onus and focus of all his work on what he did to illuminate the practice of yoga. I mean, it's just as important as anything he did on the magic side, but that was his non-ego sort of being. But he wrote that. He took the time to project that and to get that out there. I think that there's this two-sided coin to Crowley that he was fully aware of, but he did the unforgivable thing of having fun with the ego. He just took it to its most absurd limits because he knew that he was taking his non-ego to the most absurd limits. He was balancing both sides of, and I mean, there's like five people in that being, you know. He even breaks it up. He even taught, you know what I mean?
Right. I think that his relationship to that is actually far healthier than most people who are looking for higher positions, because there's no pretending. Like, and that's, he's very honest in that way. Like, he's like, this is what I want. He's like, you know, I don't know. I actually totally agree with you. I think that he could see the levels of what was happening, but he allowed it to happen anyway. It's like psychoanalysis, you know. It's like you don't try and stop the neurosis or the dysfunction in psychoanalysis. All you do is you become more and increasingly aware of what's there and allow. It's like a documentary when you don't interfere. Like if you do a documentary on ducks and the fucking duck is like dying in oil, you, part of what you do as a documentary person is not to pull the fucking duck out of the oil, but to let it die to communicate what's actually happening. You don't interfere with the thing. And so he didn't try and keep it back. He let it go. And then build awareness.
As Krishnamurti says, if you're going to be bored, just be bored. But if you're going to be Aleister Crowley, be Aleister Crowley. So in those moments when Crowley was, he found himself kind of loaded in a pub, maybe he takes a dump in the middle of the room, because that's just what Aleister Crowley does. But he's not going to get in the way of Aleister Crowley and prevent himself from doing that, because that's, in that moment, that's what you're going to do.
Right.
I guess him and Kubrick remind me of one another a little bit.
Oh,
just because
yeah.
They are kind of like big egos and big, you know, they're about, they are a bit self-absorbed, even if their message and the stuff in terms of artwork and teachings that they're putting out are provocative and actually can help you like get, you know, a step higher in your thinking and what have you. But, you know, there's that element, there's that unattachable element to them as people, because we're all people and we all have our kind of fault. I mean, I don't know if you want to call it a fault, but I mean, I think an overinflated ego can be kind of a fault. Our culture is kind of predicated on it. So I'm always trying to like disarm my own thinking though when I confront people, like, because some people are really annoying, but some of their ideas are really good. And I think that's what people have to like learn to do more of, because we all have that subconscious like, oh, this person reminds me of this person, so I'm not going to listen to them. But they might have something very interesting to say, even like if it's only 10% of their doctrine, right? I think it's like there's always truth in something. Not to say that truth is completely subjective. I don't think that completely, but there's truth in almost everything, even some of the most backward ideas, like even modern day conservatism in like America, where it's really like hard right line, you know, whatever. I want like a nice family and shit too, family values, whatever. So it's not like completely wrong. It's just the way that like shit is put out there and what have you. But anyway, my original point was just like Crowley and Kubrick kind of like remind me of one another they approach their artwork.
I've felt that many times. They're both very manipulative, but in all the best ways, you know.
And it's like that's all good, because it's like, it makes it more of a, I don't know, I've been thinking about The Shining a bit. I haven't like done anything deep into it yet, but I like the idea of trying to like model the hotel as just like inside his mind, and then what each level represents, like a, what I call like a broke, well, I don't call it, it's just a broken symmetry. So there's symmetry breaking in the hotel between levels, and that I think there's subconscious stuff in there that even he didn't know was getting in there.
Yeah.
That we'll see. I don't know. I think I might want to work on Breaking Bad first before I get too much into The Shining, because everyone's done The Shining.
But see, if you watch The Shining first, then you get to see all the stuff of The Shining. It's pretty profound.
You cut out a little bit. Can you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Yeah. If you spend some time with The Shining, then you can see how The Shining thread it all throughout Breaking Bad.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's pretty profound. There's especially one scene in particular that he drops little hints here and there to sort of like remind you to kind of put the Kubrick lens on, which I don't know why at this point I need any reminding to put the Kubrick lens on. But when you start viewing it through that lens, it's it just starts to accentuate and illuminate little hidden rooms and sort of dark spots in The Shining, if you had them. So, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
All right, so I guess you can do them conjunctively. But go ahead, David.
Well, Bill, I don't want to get into a big thing with this because I'm aware that John hasn't seen it, but did you finish Mad Men?
Yeah, I've watched it all the way up to the last episode.
The last episode?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is... There's a number of things, but I'm just going to really briefly just say that what I took away from that, one of the many things I took away from that, was that you have these people who are basically essentially doing a type of PR to the public, and their relationship to the public is not very truly personable. It's more like objectifying the public and trying to meet them with what they want. They're manipulating the public, right? With their advertising. Now, what seems to happen in the last two seasons, especially, is that what I was taking from that was that these people in Hollywood are these people who are making these films. Like, they focus heavily on Rosemary's Baby, and they focus heavily on one season, then the next season they focus heavily on 2001 A Space Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And what I took from that was that the people who made those films were doing the same thing that they were doing to the public, in shaping the mindset of steering their consciousness, and that they were so immersed in their own activity of that, yet they weren't able to register that it was being done to them. So it was like, if there was a pyramid, they're on one level of the pyramid as advertisers on Madison Avenue, and then they're not able to conceive of the degree to which they're being played by the next level up the pyramid. Does that make sense to you?
That's beautiful. No, perfect. You just aligned it beautifully. The previous season is Rosemary's Baby, which comes out in 60. What year did that come out?
68.
And 2001 came out a little later in 68.
I believe so. Okay. So I should know that. But I think so.
Yeah. But like, they're in this little sphere doing what they do, knowing full well that they're projecting out into the world, and they've got their hand on some sort of puppet strings. But then you see the larger world of Hollywood controlling that sphere. And does anyone really recognize that the controlled are being controlled or something?
Yeah.
I kind of had a breakthrough. I just kind of see what you saw into it is the final scene with Bert Cooper dancing.
Yeah.
After he's dead. Was there anything about that resonated with you or did that you took from that scene?
Yeah, there was, but I can't even remember what he sang. I don't remember what it was.
Apparently, the actor was sort of a song and dance man back in the day. So, as an actor, he had, you know, done the song and dance routine before. For me, it was, why did he appear to Don Draper in, you know, like, I mean, it's a confining stretch, but there's one stretch where you could say, out of all the people in the office, why did he pick Don Draper to appear to as he was leaving?
Oh, there was a thing with, okay, so that was the deal. It was all about the moon. So it's kind of coming back to me. I wish I watched it right before this, but I like I said, I don't want to go into a huge thing of Mad Men because I don't want to, you know, I want to stay focused here somewhat, but we do tangents, whatever, and but I like it when everyone can relate to them. But there was the focus with the moon, and so they're talking moon, moon, moon. You know when the Hilton guy showed up earlier and mm-hmm. he didn't want to do the fucking advertisement because it had nothing to do with the moon. And then the end of the season, everyone's watching the moon landing. But then when you look at Peggy's pitch for the hamburger deal, she's all about don't you wish that there was a place you could go where her description of it is basically the moon. So she's like going to this other place. And I went to this weird kind of zone with it where, you know, there's this idea that Jung had that the souls go to the moon. Do you know that? It's in the Red Book. But
and Gurdjieff had the same thing.
Well, I mean, he didn't come up with this. He's just referencing it, Jung. But basically, that there's this man who's dead at this point, right? And he shows up and he does this little number. But it was everything centered around Peggy. Peggy is the peg. Like the first episode of Mad Men is Peggy's first day at the place as a secretary, mm-hmm. you know. And then the last episode of Mad Men is her like, okay, she's made it. She just did the fucking pitch. She nailed it. She's like established herself, and
she's made.
Yeah, and Dawn's stepping out of the way because Dawn is the dick. He's the masculinity. He's like overbearing. You know, he's aggression. You know, he's all everything that's wrong and right at the same time of masculinity, and like he steps out of the way. So he's like, I'm a side of the energy polarity, and I recognize the importance of moving over for the other side of the energy polarity to have its turn, or to take its place. And so it's got this kind of Aquarian feel in that sense, because it's like about Peggy's, you know, like stepping up. But everything came down to the moon. That the moon was the other place, but it's also death or something. I don't know. It was heavy.
I also felt like Cooper appeared to Draper because Cooper has known for a long time that Draper is an actor this whole time. Every day that Draper spent working for Cooper has been as an actor. And he performed his role better than anybody because he was an actor. He had some separation. If anyone's got separation from their real self and this false work environment where they're doing this PR manipulation kind of thing, is Draper. I mean, his mortal wound, the fact that, you know, he's living a lie, is his saving grace. You know, that's what makes him so good. And I think that Bert Cooper reveals himself in this movie, this obvious break from reality to Don Draper, is because he's the only one who really understood Bert Cooper or something. Because Cooper is kind of this odd guy, right? He's got everyone takes off their shoes when they go into his office. He's got this completely removed aesthetic from everybody. He's definitely ahead of the curve as far as artistically and culturally. And I think he sees that Don Draper will be able to shed his character and actually arrive into some sort of wholeness or some sort of fullness. And that when he does, it's going to be good, I think, for everybody. So I don't know where they're going to take the last half of that season, but it's mesmerizing for sure. Definitely have to review. I definitely have to watch basically the whole thing from episode one all the way to the end at some point again in my life. Definitely going to reveal a lot more.
Yeah, there's certain key episodes I want to watch again. I want to rewatch the Rosemary's Baby one, where they make the advertisement to present it as a conspiracy. And then I want to watch the Babylon episode where they use Joaquin and Boaz and it's all over the fucking maypole and everything.
You know how in Eyes Wide Shut they show the sociology book in the room of Domino?
Yeah, the purple book, yeah.
Right. And so the whole key about that is that that Dr. Bill doesn't realize that people above him and below him see him for who he is. Or they have a defined place where that person exists. So like Domino, when she's out in the street corner, she sees Dr. Bill walking by. She can peg him in a second.
Right.
And she just sees, oh, this guy's got money. This guy's not a psycho. She can just tell that this is like this nice guy.
Right.
And, but he's still a man. So boom, got a customer.
Right.
When Dr. Bill goes to the house out in the country, everyone there just knows from the instant he pulls up in a cab that he doesn't belong.
Right, right. He fits the bill.
He fits the bill, that there's just this obvious gloss on him that he's drenched in, that sociologically it's like, duh, like, but he doesn't know because he's in his own world. I love those scenes out in California with Draper's wife, the actress, Megan. She has no clue. Like when Dom's daughter comes there and she's pregnant, and she's obviously homeless, and she's obviously like connected with some pretty bad people. Like, Megan doesn't realize that this person who walks straight into her house gets a check for $1,000, that she's like this easy mark. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. She's living out in the valley. She thinks she's in this like safe world of LA because she's arrived. She's an actress. She doesn't realize there's this whole world around her ready to just devour her. Like they believe what the TV has shown them, right? They believe that the reality is just as safe as their TV or something. Yeah. I just thought that the sociological angle is something that was hidden for a lot of those people coming out of the 50s,
I have a question for you. I should know this, but excuse my ignorance, but is Fidelio where the Ninth Symphony comes from? Is that the opera?
No.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure.
I think it might be, man. I could look it up really quick. I don't want to take too much to say. But, I mean, the thing with the Ninth Symphony, and I talked about this with Mark on last time we talked, was that that's used all over the world by every fucking dictatorship on the planet, practically. The Ode to Joy. And that shows up in A Clockwork Orange. Everything centers around it. It's how I just did this recent sync, was because of Ode to Joy. Where is it?
Ode to Freud, right?
Ode to Freud. Well, no, it's just... So I don't know. I just see that as the same principle in Eyes Wide Shut, where you can see that there's all these people, you know, who are part of this. They're all meeting for this ritual, but they're all from different places. And it's like this idea that everyone's kind of on the same page, even though they're supposed to be on different pages. You know what I'm saying?
Maybe.
Well, because that's what Ode to Joy was. Ode to Joy was a thing that everyone could relate to.
Okay.
And even though they're supposed to not be together, you know. Beethoven shared this. I don't know. Doesn't look like it, but I mean, close enough. It's a Beethoven opera, but still, I thought it was actually sometimes known as the choral. Huh? Am I pronouncing that right? Okay. Whatever. Fuck it. In 2001, Beethoven's autographed score of the Ninth Symphony, held by the Berlin State Library, was added to the United Nations World Heritage List, becoming the first musical score to be so honored. Congratulations. Anyways, sorry, that was sidetracked. I just wanted to know. I should have known that in the first place.
Dude, the way that guy got his ideas is awesome.
What's that?
The way he got his ideas is really awesome.
Kubrick? Or Beethoven?
No, Beethoven. I mean, I'm sure maybe Kubrick, and I think all creative geniuses probably have flashes like they do. Where it's just like you get the entire picture of an arrangement or a piece of art or anything. The really great people of masters of a craft, like they just have that ability to tap into like whatever and to pull back like an entire image of what it is. Even technologists, like a lot of different people. But anyway, that just struck me about him, and that's in the back of my mind, that's what I think about now.
Ode to Joy is weird because it's vague, and it's purposefully vague in a very particular kind of way, because it doesn't tell you at the expense. Like, at the expense of what? Like, at the expense of who? Like, it's like freedom and the pursuit of happiness, you know? It's like, to what end, you know? it's kind of a weird song.
Yeah.
I want to see if, you know, this idea of where ideas come from, I want to see if we can connect this to Maureen Dowd in some way, because I don't know if you guys have talked about the Maureen Dowd article on the show.
No.
What does she write about? The name is familiar, but you'd have to remember.
So I think she's like a Pulitzer-winning journalist. She writes, I think, for the New York Times right now.
Is she a science journalist? No, Maureen Dowd, no.
No, I think
but go on.
Commentary. She wrote an article, I think, about a month ago where she was in Colorado and she took it upon herself to experiment with legal marijuana. So she went to a dispensary or a pot shop. She bought a candy bar, took it back to her hotel room, started nibbling on it, didn't feel any effect, and then made the wise decision to eat the whole thing.
Oh my God.
And in the course of eating the whole thing, still nothing happened. She just was like, well, this is, you know, a kind of a dud. And then, you know, about an hour and 15 minutes into the whole affair, a shudder, as she said, ran down her spine. And she spent the next 8 hours in a fetal position in her hotel room, convinced that she had died and that no one had told her. She said she went through like just a paranoid nightmare that I think anyone who has eaten too much brownies or what have you and was not expecting the Titanic transition that's involved there.
Oh my God. But eating that stuff is like practically psychedelic if you eat enough of it. That's like, of course. Hang on. Are like anti-marijuana folks jumping on this being like, oh, look how evil this shit is, or what's being played
down
about
this
it?
This is the angle about it that I find absolutely fascinating. There's a couple of them. First of all, the article has a certain edge to it that is completely new because this was a legal thing that she did. She didn't break any law, and that sort of cuts away at some of the morality of the whole thing. Basically, now what she has done was done from a position of ignorance, because she dove in headfirst without reading about it, without taking the time to be instructed about it. She was stupid, right? It was as if she chugged, you know, a pint of whiskey. The other angle about it that I think is fascinating about this is that apparently the amount that she ate, I guess it wasn't printed on the package, but according to the manufacturer, which is bizarre, of the candy bar, that there was enough for 16 novice doses in that candy bar.
Oh, my God.
So a novice dose, you probably triple that for someone who's probably experience. So you're talking about 5 good-sized brownies that she just shoved down her cake hole and she paid the consequences. But now here's the thing that I think is fascinating. If she had done the same thing with alcohol, she would have been in the hospital. She would not have. She would have called 911. She would have been vomiting. She would have had alcohol poisoning. If you had consumed the amount of alcohol that it relatively, relative speaking to what she did with this substance, right? But here's the thing, what I find, I guess I want to ask your opinion on. The experience she had, I don't believe, is an objective experience.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that her experience is subjective in the sense that it was Maureen Dowd who organized who had made certain choices and had certain information privy to her and had a certain understanding of about or certain belief about what she was doing and what she had done that colored her experience to where she made the observation that I had died and no one had told me. That's a completely subjective.
Sure.
That she did the math on it and that's what she got. Now, if she lived in a different culture,
right?
If she had read about it, if she had a different intention, even if she had made the mistake, or if she didn't, let's put it this way, if she didn't accidentally eat the whole thing, but she did eat the whole thing on purpose, knowing how much was in there, could she have had a positive experience?
Of
course.
I ate probably enough for well over 10 people one time on accident while drunk at a party. I moved into this community and like they were all on this table and they had skulls fucking painted on with the frosting, you know, and I had been drinking and I know what it tastes like, but I wasn't thinking. Like I was just eating and I ate one after another, after another, after another. And same thing, I ended up curling up in a little ball in my room, and it was extremely nauseous, extreme, like, just like, oh, I've just fucking felt terrible. It was not a positive experience at all.
Now, what were you eating, scones?
No, I ate cookies, but they were okay. Large cookies, and I ate a ton of them. I was just, like, treating it like it was my dinner. I was like, oh, I haven't eaten, oh, there's some cookies here. And then I'm like, after like, I don't know, whatever it was, like the fifth one, and they were big, I was just like, well, this fucking taste. I was like, I know this taste. What is this taste? Oh, I'm fucking eating weed. Oh, shit, that explains the skulls. Oh, shit, I'm feeling it. And then it came on, and I mean, I wasn't super drunk before I did it, but I had drank enough that I wasn't, like, I just wasn't registering.
You know
what I was doing.
My brother and I just talked about this the other night, and we were like, you know, imagine a shaman or something in indigenous culture who that is his life. I mean, his living is to experiment with psychedelics and to like pull back useful information for the tribe in a lot of ways. And we were hypothesizing like how much we think like sometimes they take and like the amount they can take and like superhuman doses. And we were contemplating like, you know, how would they fit into other cultures and how many people in our culture would like that apply to, like they're super psychedelic or they have like super stamina and can enter psychedelic realms and nobody else can. But that's either outlawed in our culture or stigmatized in such ways that someone with that like skill or something, it would never even be realized. And so it's interesting that that would be like a creative capacity of human of a human mm-hmm. to be able to like really delve into these realms. And I'm sure one of those guys has fucking done five brownies worth and had no problem. And I'm sure there's people in our culture that have like, you know, under right context and whatnot, and you can take that much and totally be fine. If you mix and like do it at a party and shit, like man, with the music and stuff too, that messes with your body in so many weird ways. It's like that's not like a fair assessment.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't pleasant, but like I did it, and like I didn't. I mean, I endured it. Like I didn't like freak out or anything. You know, I just was like present with the experience, and it was really intense. And that was that. Eventually, you know, but I mean, you know, my last ayahuasca experience where I just purged for 20 hours straight, literally, and felt like I'd been shot in the stomach and then spent 4 days in the hospital. You know, I handled that deal, like, pretty well. I mean, I moaned a lot because I couldn't help it. But up until the hospital, when they were running tests for 4 hours, then I hyperventilated. My fucking fingers bent back, and I looked like I was, you know, in The Exorcist or whatever. Like, there was a breaking point, you know. But that was a pain breaking point than the psychedelic breaking point, because this was, of course, at this point, like, you know, well over 24 hours or something, you know, or around 24 hours, actually, as to when I took it, you know. Yeah, I mean, but that's a different matter, I guess, because I wasn't able to endure the trip, quote unquote, you know. But pain, you reach a certain point with pain, it's like every, like, your whole, there is like a breaking point, at least for me. I mean, maybe Jesus didn't have that breaking point, but woo.
Yeah, I mean, that's like still pretty intense. And correct me if I'm wrong, but ayahuasca, it's, you experience it more when your eyes are closed versus can you like open your eyes and be lucid, or is it like an all the time kind of thing? I thought it was only when your eyes are closed.
It can go any way. Like,
is that wrong?
It can go either way. Yeah. A lot of times you can close your eyes and you open your eyes, and you, but it also depends on what you ate beforehand, how well you were to the diet, what it is that you need to purge, what you have going on. Like, there's so many factors, and it's different every time. I mean, just to clarify, my stomach, my upper intestine was twisted, and so I wasn't able to digest the medicine, which is an extremely rare occurrence to happen. And so I basically, I had a knot in my stomach for fucking, you know, I mean, the knot was there for like probably 30 hours or something. I didn't get to eat for 2 weeks after this, solid food, really. I mean, I introduced it in the course of 2 weeks again, yeah, if you eat like a banana that has like a little bit of mold or something on it, you know, or whatever, like an avocado, that will make your visions more intense, to the point where when you open your eyes, sometimes you can't even see anything but visions, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's chemistry.
Now, yeah. The collision of your twisted, had you felt symptoms of your twisted intestines days before?
No.
You drank ayahuasca?
No. This is something that showed up that night. And that I was basically told at the hospital by the doctors that there were two unrelated but not unrelated incidents. I mean, it was unrelated in the sense that that it just happened on its own to a degree. I mean, but there was factors involved that had to do with what I was doing. And so I wasn't able to drink water because it's purgative. And so I because I wasn't able to drink water, I wasn't able to work it out like I normally would have been able to. And so I didn't go into the fast as properly as I could have. I mean, I did okay, but I could have done it better. I could have introduced not the, you know, I could have gone into it with easing off of more solid food. And that would have helped. It was a combination of things. The medicine just, you know, didn't make it any easier, basically.
Now, see, I'm just trying to put this out there. I'm not judging anyway. And I think we've talked about this before, but this idea of if ayahuasca or strong psychedelics is medicine, then how long must it take medicine? Are we always sick? Are we always getting sick? Do we call it medicine because we are ill? Or is there a point where the medicine has done its job and we no longer need the medicine?
Well, you know, so that, like, you know that it's medicine when you the next day feel like you just did something incredibly good for yourself, which up until my last experience has always been the case. Just like my whole being needed that thank you, like total gratitude. Like real genuine gratitude to like the universe for like allowing you to release, because it releases on so many different levels, and it also, it kills parasites on a base level, on a dense physical level. It kills anaerobic bacteria. It's the only substance known to man that can help rebuild serotonin receptor sites. They've done studies with that are legitimate, like studies where they've shown that. There's nothing else like that, man. Like, fucking kill, like, it's pretty unbelievable. And so, and then
Marijuana is similar. I don't know. You're cutting out for me. I don't know.
Am I cutting out? Am I cutting out?
Yeah, I lost it.
Oh, you don't hear me? Can you hear me now?
You're cutting out pretty hard.
Can you hear me now?
I think.
Can you hear me now?
A little bit.
Huh. I wonder if it'll stay in the recording. Last time I cut out for you guys, it stayed in the recording. So I don't know.
But I mean, I think it'll probably correct itself.
Yeah, it's important for you to, hear me.
Yeah, I agree.
So back to this Maureen. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. So with a substance like alcohol, right, it's going to – if you overdose, if you take way much more than you should, that experience is going to be pretty objective. There's no amount of – other than being – an alcoholic and drinking every day so that you can grow a tolerance for that amount. But there's no amount of like diet and meditation or perspective or intention where, you know, chugging a gallon of vodka is going to change the experience. You're going to black out. You're going to purge. You're going to have alcohol poisoning. You're going to need to go to the hospital. But if you do this with psychoactive substances like marijuana or ayahuasca, you have some sort of cognitive and intentional control over what will happen.
Well, but ayahuasca is much different than, say, LSD in the way that you can actually maintain complete objectivity in the midst of the craziest shit ever. So, which I've seen with people with LSD, where they've completely not even like they've forgotten for the most part that they've even taken something or that something's influencing them, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas like it's not really the same with ayahuasca. It's like you see it, you're very aware that you took something and that it's working on you and it's doing something. Like I mean, there's worse things. Salvia is worse in that regard. Salvia, you can lose all objectivity. And that's kind of fucked up. We've talked about this before, you and I.
Yeah. But it's amazing that now that marijuana is legal in two states, and so now you have this other substance there where someone's first cross-the-line experience. Well, let's put it this way. When marijuana was illegal, I mean, cooking marijuana was very rare. It'd be like almost like a treat or a special occasion where you would see edible marijuana. But with shops out there, people are going to buy more and more edible marijuana. And I think that having these breakthrough experiences that like Maureen Dowd wrote about are going to be happening more and more and more often. But the flavor of that experience is not set in stone. It's like not everyone will have to have the Maureen Dowd paranoid, I think I'm dead experience. Right. The more that the culture kind of adapts to the potency and the and the nature of this substance, that is going to change the nature of people's experiences. So the way that I kind of frame this is sort of like edible marijuana is like a bottle rocket, right? And if you light it, when it's on your living room table, you have no idea where that thing's going to go. And it could very possibly spin around, bounce off a wall, come back and explode in your face.
Well,
right?
I'll tell you one thing. I purged my guts out that night when I overdid that, eventually after a long time. But I'll tell you, like in my experience, I was just talking to Amy about this. I never thought that I would get to the point where I would welcome that in the way that I do. And it was really strange, actually. I went to an event and I ate a small little mushroom and I did not feel that I had taken a mushroom. I felt that I was on ayahuasca, like for real. And after this traumatic incident, and I went for a walk to find a place to vomit. And I'm walking and walking and walking and walking along this road for the longest time looking for the proper place where it's not on someone's tent, you know? And I find this spot, and my friend rides up behind me right before I'm about to vomit. And it's my friend who introduced me to the community that I did this with. And she's there. She was there the first time I did ayahuasca, and she took my bucket away and gave me another bucket, and she rolled up right before I purged at an event with like probably 1,500 people.
Wow.
And I hadn't seen her yet at the event, and then she's there and she held space for me. Like, yeah, there's definitely like synchronicity with that. I mean, that's why Jake Kotza, you know, I can see the impact that it's had, because that things happen that are just like unbelievable. I mean, things happen anyway, but it taps it directly into the heart of the synchronistic web. It's kind of far out.
Well, I have always noticed that whenever you're in that space, that psychedelic space, you seem to be in the shadow of reality. Like, people on the other side, they're removed. There is a web that you enter that is undeniable. I mean, if it's only happened to you once, it's very easy to miss. If you go back there a couple of times and you observe a phenomenon happen again, it becomes less phenomenal. I mean, it becomes more magical, but it's not as like an outlier. It's just sort of like,
yeah.
Oh yeah, this is where I am.
You familiarize yourself with the zone.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
But this bottle rocket analogy of eating pot without knowing what you're doing is like lighting a bottle rocket on your table in your living room. It's you don't know where it's going to go, and it's a foolish.
You have a relative idea of where it's going to go.
You can provide some scaffolding for the rocket. You can provide something that sort of directs it into at least a launching zone, and I think that's what education, that's what knowledge, that's what solid, sophisticated education before you go into the experience with knowledge of it provides.
The right thing, but it must be the wrong.